Welcome to Expert Second Opinion. Investigators discuss the optimal management of HER2-positive gastrointestinal cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, bringing you excerpts from a CME meeting we held on Thursday, January 8th, 2026 in San Francisco during the Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium being held during that time. The moderator for this meeting was Dr. Lionel Kanku-Fanqua from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and the faculty included Dr. Haley Ellis from the Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts, Dr. Eric von Kutzum from the University Hospitals Leuven in Leuven, Belgium, and Dr. Zev Weinberg from the UCLA School of Medicine in Los Angeles, California. Dr. Ellis began the meeting with a presentation on HER2-positive biliary tract cancers, followed by Dr. Weinberg, who commented on HER2-positive gastroesophageal cancers, and finally Professor von Kutzum, who talked about HER2-positive colorectal cancer. To begin, Dr. Fanqua presented a question from the audience.
There was a question that came from the audience asking about perspectives on real-world stigma potential in biliary tract cancers and gastric cancer, given the TIGIT data to date. So we know TIGIT has been a target. It's an exhaustion marker. We know some of the data in HCC, lung cancer, that hasn't been the greatest. So questions about the potential of TIGIT in biliary tract cancer and gastric cancer. Maybe we'll start with Dr. Ellis, and then we'll go to Dr. Weinberg.
The Artemide study in BTC is an adjuvant study looking at the combination of Rilva with chemo. That recently just finished enrolling, so I think we will eagerly await the data for that. I think our standard of care has been capecitabine for many years now, so we'll see if there's a signal from adding PD-1 TIGIT targeting in the adjuvant space.
So in that context, all they need to do is be a capecitabine in the adjuvant. And here what you have to show is your TIGIT combination is going to be better than the existing standard of care, which you already saw today has a 2-year overall survival. So personally, you know, having been involved with TIGIT drugs, I think it's a big challenge. And we've had a bunch of negative failures in TIGIT now, most recently in gastric cancer with the STAR-221 study. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, okay, is this going to be a fruitful exercise? You have to achieve pretty much a median overall survival of close to 2.5 years, probably, to show a statistically significant benefit. So it will be a tough challenge, in my opinion.
Yeah, indeed, the TIGIT antibodies, most of the studies, or all the studies that were reported were negative. But this is different. This is bispecific antibody, so we still should look at the data. Of course, we don't know, and everybody is now very, very cautious with the negative studies. And we saw also some recent press release of another study that was negative with the TIGIT antibody in gastric cancer. So it's going to be difficult, but this is a bispecific antibody.
Correct. And I think there was a phase 2 trial, I think, that was done in biliary tract cancers, chemo with the PD-L1 TIGIT inhibition. That was positive, but I'm not sure it was a bispecific. So more to come on the TIGIT. Thank you. The other question that was before we move on to gastroesophageal cancers, Dr. Ellis, there were a couple of follow-up questions. How do you approach second and third line for biliary tract cancers without a target?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in the biomarker agnostic space, it's kind of wide open at the moment. We've certainly seen, you know, a number of studies looking at 5-FU-based therapies, FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, NALIRI, with pretty equivalent outcomes across the board. I think there's a huge interest in trying to develop novel agents in that space. The CTX-009 study, which is a VEGF DLL4 bispecific. You know, we'll see what the survival data looks like from that, but the response rate was 17% versus about 5%. Again, the bar is perhaps a bit lower in BTC than it is in gastric cancer because our standard of care is just insufficient at this point.
Agreed. And an area of unmet need and definitely where we need to enroll more patients in clinical trials. Last, before I move on, there was a question about a patient with osteoarthritis and metastatic intrahepatic cholangio, HER2-3+, progressing on chemoimmunotherapy. What HER2-directed therapy would you use in the second line? Trastuzumab, pertuzumab, trastuzumab, tucatinib, TDXD, or zanidatamab?
I mean, it's great to have a wealth of options that are now in the NCCN guidelines. I think certainly there's patient-shared decision-making that comes into that. A lot of patients, after they've had frontline chemoimmunotherapy with gemcitabine-based chemo, are pretty fatigued from chemo. So I think something like zanidatamab can be very attractive because it's sort of chemo-free in a sense. And the efficacy of T-DXd and zanidatamab is excellent in the second-line setting. So it's great to have multiple options. But I think definitely, as we discussed, non-biomarker-driven options are insufficient. So if you have HER2, I would definitely target it.
And the duration of response was also very impressive. Is that an
15 months, yes.
I don't know if Eric or Seth have additional comments.
Yeah, I think the data are clearly there. We have two options. That's zanidatamab and trastuzumab deruxtecan in this situation. And the future, we will learn what is the best option in this setting. But both are options, clearly. And we will sequence them probably in many patients.
Okay, thank you. So we'll move on to the cases for gastroesophageal cancer. So the first case, 69-year-old gentleman with stage 2 disease, treated with a cross regimen, had local recurrence 15 months after that, after a resection. PD-L1 positive, CPS 10, HER2 positive. Local recurrence treated with FOLFOX, trastuzumab, pembrolizumab. And then he unfortunately developed an isolated brain met, which was resected. Would you give adjuvant T-DXd for how long?
So it's a good question. I mean, I think that, first of all, this is not an infrequent situation. HER2-positive gastric cancer does have a predilection to go to the CNS. So we do see, especially because of better outcomes, we see some patients living, going into some sort of remission and then recurring with brain metastases. Now, if it's isolated, fully resected, and adjuvantly treated with adjuvant radiation, I would not do further therapy. I would watch this patient and not necessarily do T-DXd or anything else for that matter. I would just watch this patient off therapy.
And these cases do happen. What's the CNS penetration of T-DXd compared to something like tucatinib, extrapolating from the data from breast cancer?
Well, you know, ADCs, I don't think we really know fully how well these drugs do penetrate the CNS. You're right, tucatinib is a TKI that does have brain metastasis. I've actually used it in HER2-positive gastric cancer, even though it's not approved and is off-label. But I think we don't really know what the degree of penetration with T-DXd is, certainly in gastric cancer.
58-year-old gentleman with HER2-positive G-junction cancer, treated with FOLFOX, trastuzumab, nivolumab, progress with lymph nodes, in the lymph nodes and brain mets. Now, second-line treatment with T-DXd, is there a role for zanidatamab third-line?
I don't think so. This strikes me as one of these patients who may not even be HER2-positive anymore, but obviously, they'd have to take a look at that. I would prefer, usually in these patients, actually, after two lines of anti-HER2 therapy, doing a cytotoxic chemotherapy, especially with brain metastasis. I would think about paclitaxel ramucirumab or even paclitaxel taxane by itself that does have CNS penetration.
And you did bring up the idea of rebiopsying. Obviously, you described the heterogeneity, both spatial and temporal. Eric, is that something you do routinely, or?
Yeah, we try to recommend to do routine biopsies in the DESTINY studies, the DESTINY, at least the gastric 02, DESTINY gastric 04 study. This was mandatory. The label doesn't say that you have to do it. So we try to have a pragmatic attitude, if possible, if easily, if you can take an easy biopsy, then I would do it. If, of course, taking biopsies is very risky, then I would not do it. The reality is that patients may lose HER2 expression after a prior treatment, and we don't know what's going to happen now if zanidatamab is going to be in first line. There are some suggestions that many of the patients, or most of the patients even, may have lost their HER2 expression when they progress on zanidatamab. So in this situation, a biopsy would be for sure needed.
And since you're on the topic of heterogeneity, we know that there's a discordance between IHC and NGS. And, you know, so at baseline, what platform do you use? Do you use IHC, NGS, liquid, all three to kind of capture the whole picture?
I mean, at baseline, you know, IHC testing is pretty standard, and you get a rapid turnaround in a day. So you pretty much know a few days. You know if patients HER2 positive from the get-go. I think later on after progression, you know, if it's not, like Eric said, if it's difficult to biopsy, I actually find ctDNA to be pretty reliable for HER2. Copy numbers, you know, if those patients are really still HER2 positive, you're going to pick it up on a ctDNA study, particularly in gastric cancer.
We'll go on to the next case here, 56-year-old gentleman with stage 4 G junction cancer to the liver, CPS1, HER2-3+, progress on chemo, targeted therapy, and immunotherapy. You're planning to give T-DXd in the second line. Unfortunately, repeat biopsy shows IC2+, FISH negative, NGS is positive for HER2-activating mutation. So what do you do here? Do you go with T-DXd, knowing the data, and what's the data for activating mutations versus, you know, amplification or overexpression?
So in gastric cancer, activating mutations are not that common, but, you know, sometimes it happens. There's not great data, actually, with T-DXd in this context, to my knowledge. I don't know if I would actually treat this patient with T-DXd at all. I think this is also somebody who I might say, hey, this isn't HER2 positive anymore. This is HER2 mutated. That's a different thing. And personally, I'd probably treat this patient with paclitaxel ramucirumab.
Great. 53-year-old gentleman, HER2-positive, amplified G-junction cancer, PD-L1 positive, progress on frontline chemo, immunotherapy, targeted therapy. Before considering second-line options, how important is it to rebiopsy? I think we've talked about that. Is there any role in HER2-targeted therapy in 1+ versus 2+? Again, I think we covered that pretty well. But mechanistically, zanidatamab, T-DXd, what are your thoughts?
So zanidatamab, I don't think, you know, here has been studied well at all in this 1+, 2+ setting. You have very little data. You saw it from Japan in the 2+-ish negative patients showing, you know, maybe 20% response rate, but out of 30, 40 patients. I mean, again, I think these are the kind of patients that are probably not necessarily that strongly HER2 positive anymore. And, you know, that represents 30 to 40% of patients. It's really a unique situation. And I don't know if anti-HER2 therapy should be considered necessarily in patients that are no longer HER2 positive.
Okay. All right. So 73-year-old female, dysphagia endoscopy found to have a semi-obstructive mass in the G-junction, HER2 positive, no metastasis. Would you use HER2, what new adjuvant approach would you recommend? I guess the question is there a role for HER2 targeting in a new adjuvant setting?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good question and a real practical question. I think when it's 3+, you know, you really are tempted. HER2 2+ FISH, I mean, you just saw today in the zanidatamab data, they don't do as well with anti-HER2 therapies. The benefit clearly isn't there. Now, I will say there's a study, the FIRFLOT study, that looked at FLOT, which is the standard of care in this patient, assuming that this patient is being treated with surgical intent, FLOT plus durvalumab. We don't know how many patients were enrolled with on Matterhorn with HER2 positive, but some probably were. It's something they're going to look at. There is a study called the FIRFLOT. I was referring to that earlier. That was FLOT, pembrolizumab, trastuzumab, and had a very high pathological response rate, upwards of 40 or 50%. Now, single-arm phase 2 study, I think the randomized study is ongoing at this time. But, you know, I must confess, I have used that regimen in HER2 3+ patients because I feel that pathological, very high response rate was very compelling. I don't know, Eric, it's a European study, so yeah, he probably knows more about it.
I'm not involved in the study. It's a German study. I completely agree. But they reported also several patients who died on the study. So we have to be careful before giving a general recommendation. But it's tempting. In a patient like that, I would like to see also the CT scan to see whether the patient is resectable, whether it's a tumor that's growing intraluminally or extraluminally, whether it's locally advanced disease. Then you have a more, let's say, if it's unresectable, then you would go more even for a HER2-targeted therapy in this setting.
And I would like to see, and I'm pretty sure, maybe Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure Matterhorn did not look at HER2. So I don't know if it was an exclusion criteria there. Maybe you could correct me. But I think I would be interested in the end. That's something that they're going to look at when they look at all the tissue. Were some of the patients on their HER2, and what was the benefit of the checkpoint inhibitor in that patient population? It'll be interesting.
We have a couple of questions from the audience. I think the first one, 40-year-old metastatic gastric cancer, PD-L1 5% HER2 positive, FOLFOX, trastuzumab, pembro in the front line, second line T-DXd now progressing, good performance status. Role for zanidatamab after progression. I think we can.
You know, I mean, look, single agent activity. I don't know if you're gonna. We're gonna get zanidatamab for that patient. Remember, it's not approved for. It's approved for biliary tract, not really approved for gastric cancer at all. If the patient has good performance status, and you know, you can somehow magically get that drug paid for, that seems reasonable to me. And someone who's still HER2 driven, and you know the drug has single agent activity in this country. I think we do tend to petition insurance providers for those kind of off-label use on occasion.
Right. So I know there was a asked about activating mutations earlier. I think there's a question about agents like zongertinib that are used in HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer. Is there a potential role here in patients with activating mutations?
Yes, so it depends. First of all, I think it depends on where the point mutation is, right? Because zongertinib looks like a fantastic HER2 TKI in lung cancer. I mean, and you know, but that may not have the same point mutation as this patient with gastric cancer. I did see in their phase one study, they did have some responders with gastric cancer. So I think it's feasible to again, something to consider, assuming that those point mutations are of the same type that the lung cancer patients got.
Great. Maybe the second online and last online question here. Maybe Dr. Ellis, you could take this one. 64-year-old metastatic gastric cancer, HER2 positive, CPS 10, coronary artery disease, hypertension, frontline chemo, immunotherapy, trastuzumab, partial response, progress after 9 months, and then second line T-DXd with marked response, complicated by grade 1 ILD, and requiring dose interruption. So now the patient, what patient or disease factors should guide choice of T-DXd versus a non-ADC HER2 therapy, particularly regarding the ILD risk and the performance status?
Yeah, so I think ILD is a real toxicity that we have to monitor very closely for and certainly have a very low threshold for interrupting therapy. I think sort of this is probably a good opportunity when you have toxicity to reassess HER2 status, make sure there's still truly positive either by tissue or by liquid NGS. I really like Zev's idea for looking at copy number. But I would be hesitant about rechallenging with T-DXd unless, because we do have other non-HER2 targeting options if needed.
What if I twist that a little bit and say the patient had resolved pneumonitis, so had a history of pneumonitis? Eric, I see you smiling. How would you approach that?
Yeah, if the patient had a history, there is, and it was completely resolved, and if it was only a grade one, as right. you said, then there is no contraindication, then you can do it. Depends on the different options. If you would have different options, you could also go for another option. But nothing is wrong if you have only that option to reintroduce, to restart again in this patient, if it was completely resolved.
And a 56-year-old metastatic GE junction cancer progressed on FLUT plus nivolumab, new liver lesion, HER2-positive CPS greater than 1. Should I consider 5-FU-oxaliplatin trastuzumab pembro? Is durvalumab better? What about T-DXd for this patient? Is there any
time? Yeah, so it's a good question. And you know, how long after the FLUT the patient progressed, right, is one of the important variables. Someone progressed within 3 months of FLOT, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to put them on FOLFOX. So I think definitely anti-HER2 therapy has to be part of the equation. And whether it's T-DXd or whether you want to use, off-label FOLFIRI with trastuzumab that a lot of people have experience with, I think either of those are reasonable. I would definitely have that patient get follow-up over time whether they still retain HER2 positivity. That might be a patient for, you know, the zanidatamab ultimately, because that patient hasn't had yet an anti-HER2 and they have had a checkpoint inhibitor.
Great. So before we move on, maybe a question for anyone on the panel. So with the data presented today with the zanidatamab data, obviously potentially practice changing, in the front line, should that regimen get approved? We shouldn't do cross-track comparisons, but you know, which regimen would you use? The KEYNOTE-811? Does the Horizon have an edge?
So, I mean, I think so. Number one, we have to see. I think again, what arm C did compared to arm B. And we'll probably have the answer to that before the FDA actually approves this regimen. Now, I do think, based on the data presented today, personally, I think zanidatinib is a far superior anti-HER2 agent, and we should probably be considering that as the base. Now, the question that comes up, which is pretty challenging, is that our new standard of care? Is our new standard of care, or do we continue with FOLFOX, trastuzumab, pembro? Because, after all, that wasn't the control arm in this study. So I think I think I'd be comfortable with both of those personally. I think at the end, it's going to be immunotherapy will probably be continued in this patient population, probably with tislelizumab, because we all gravitate towards immunotherapy naturally. So I think at the end of the day, when all the dust settles, that's probably where we'll be. And we'll have to see what the FDA looks at it. It's not going to be so easy. There are a lot of unanswered questions still in the data set. So I'm going to be really curious to see how the FDA looks at all this data. I think they did meet their primary endpoint pretty convincingly, though.
And they seem to be benefiting both PD-L, regardless of PD-L1 status. So.
Yeah, which is, again, counterintuitive and changes, what we saw with KEYNOTE-811.
Great. Thank you so much for that.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Expert Second Opinion, Management of HER2-Positive Gastrointestinal Cancers.